through the area through the morning. Supposed to get a little bit heavier mid-morning. Here are the current numbers. Wind is from the east at 21, gusting to 35 miles per hour. Raining, 56 degrees Kenosha, 55 for Racine, Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. On today's program, we're hearing a disturbing story from the world of football. The preponderance of deaths that do not necessarily occur out on the playing field during the actual playing of games, but deaths that occur during conditioning workouts. Conditioning workouts that are constructed in such a way that potentially do much more harm than good, leading sometimes to serious injury and even death. The author of the book at hand is an investigative reporter by the name of Irvin Muchnick, well known for a number of previous books, including Wrestling Babylon, Pile-Driving Tales of Drug, Sex, Death, and Scandal, as well as Concussion Incorporated, The End of Football as We Know It. This latest book, published by ECW Press, is called Without Helmets or Shoulder Pads, The American Way of Death in Football Conditioning. It focuses in particular on three different instances in which such deaths occurred, one of them not far from here at Northwestern University. I asked Irv Muchnick at the beginning of the interview to explain the genesis of his interest in this particular phenomenon and the writing of this particular book.
Well, as I write in the introduction, I was a conventional sports writer. I've always been more interested in the behind-the-scenes aspects and the cultural underpinnings of our popular sports entertainments, and I got involved in covering, reporting on, and analyzing the public dialogue over football's fraught future vis-a-vis the issue of traumatic brain injury, and wrote a book about that called Concussion, Inc. In this new book, I want to try to reorient the public conversation away from concussions and chronic traumatic encephalopathy, which I think has been covered to a fairly well and with very little effect, because football is an existentially dangerous activity and people don't really, they're entertained by the spectacle. They don't really care about the fallout that much, especially as it relates to multi-million dollar self-selected gladiators they watch on their television screens. But what people really need to appreciate more about football is the overall context of its public health harm, of which traumatic brain injury, and frankly, even death, is just one small part. When you start talking about the fact that one or two or three or four kids, often not even of legally consenting age, are dropping dead on our fields every summer without making a single block or tackle in anger, just from the over-the-top drills of their maniacal coaches, you start to see that there's a lot more to this story than just concussions. And indeed, kids are 4.5 times as likely to die non-traumatically as they are from something that happens in the game. So I think that the football and public health involves not just death and not just concussions, but a whole bunch of things that I'd like to bring to the public consciousness with a little more vigor and purpose. And it's, you know, brain bleeds, spinal cord injuries, orthopedic damage, neurological damage, internal organ damage, and a serious diminution of the quality of life for a significant portion of the American male population, which in turn, you know, leads to metrics of opioid abuse, domestic violence, declines in workforce productivity, and on and on and on. But in this book, I dramatize this discussion by telling in depth the narratives of three young men who died in conditioning from various etiologies. But really, the bottom line is they die from football, from a sport and an activity that has an outsized purchase on the American male soul. And what can we do about it?
Hmm. Yes, at one point you write in the book, the problem of football's lethality is football. Why, in any sensible rendering of assets and deficits, are kids put in harm's way to play it? So one of the central contentions, I think, of your book is that, and you've already touched on the fact of this, is that we're in many cases talking about young people, sometimes really young people, and we're talking about a culture that springs up around this game in particular, in which speaking up about the way you are feeling or the dangerous conditions you think might exist. I mean, it's kind of hard to imagine the typical young person in that kind of scenario feeling comfortable about speaking up and saying something. I mean, being their own advocates in those situations.
Right, that's absolutely true. And really, if you look at the scenarios of these conditioning deaths, very few of them involve anything out of a kinesiology textbook or a conditioning manual that seriously gives a competitive edge that we can account for and measure. These are mostly performative exercises in making boys tough and into better specimens of masculinity. And it all leads to the question of why are our public schools subsidizing through the healthcare system, the insurance system, and school budgets a free developmental system for the $15 billion a year National Football League? I mean, why can't the parents who are determined to push their sons into this sport do so on private fields and in private programs? I know it's a big stretch to imagine that world where football is out of our public schools, but there was a time in our country when a heavyweight boxing championship fight would galvanize the nation in much the way that Super Bowl Sunday does today. And that changed, and we don't have high school boxing teams anymore. We've never had cigarette-smoking teams, and I think the football industry is in much the same position that the tobacco industry was in after the Surgeon General's report in 1964, and is doing a very skillful job of spinning the story and flipping the script and making people think that this should be a discussion about improved safety measures, which are pretty close to impossible to achieve in a forward colliding sport.
And of course, and I think this is touched on in your book, it is not unprecedented for there to be concern about the game of football. And in some respects, some of the things you are talking about, at least in some ways, bring to mind the ferocious opposition to football when this game was first played in North America. And in some respects, it shows us how we've not really come very far since over a century ago, when all kinds of people were actually sounding the alarm about this violent game.
That's very true. There's nothing new under the sun when it talks about when it comes to talking about football and safety. The origin story of football mythology around this is President Teddy Roosevelt, who supposedly saved the game from itself in the early 20th century by convening a panel of experts who tweaked the rules. The fact of the matter is football has cyclically had crises around management of death and severe injury for a century plus. Even the concussion story itself, CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, has been in the medical literature since 1920 to describe what's called the punch-drunk syndrome of boxers. And it was only the football lobby's skill and power that that kept it from being applied to the game of football until a Nigerian doctor named Dr. Bennett Omalu, with scant connection to the NFL establishment, started studying the brains of deceased players and identifying CTE in football players. So it's an old story. It's about America's infatuation with this admittedly, you know, thrilling spectacle, and not realizing that the price is paid not just by individuals but by all of us because of the assumed level of male participation in it at all levels as some sort of rite of passage that's causing a tremendous public health cost to everyone in America.
I want to give you a chance to tell our listeners about something that you write about early in the book, and in a sense it is ever so slightly off the really focused topic of your book, but I think it kind of helps us understand the root and depth of your concerns about the game at whatever level it's played. And in this particular case, you're telling us about a game, an NFL game that you attended as a sports writer back in 1989, in which the 49ers were playing the Patriots. And I think part of the reason this leapt off the page for me is because at one point you end up talking to assistant coach Mike Holmgren, who is a well-known name to those of us in Packerland as a future Green Bay Packer head coach. But I wonder if you would mind telling our listeners about what you saw unfold in that game between the 49ers and the Patriots, and in a sense how it, in a sense, helped crystallize for you the inherent violence of this game.
Yeah, well, thanks for asking. And as I said, I was a regular sports writer. In 1989, I was writing a cover story on Joe Montana for the New York Times Magazine. And I was at a game at Stanford Stadium outside Palo Alto, California, NFL game between the 49ers and the New England Patriots. The game had been moved because of the earthquake in San Francisco. And so a couple things happened. One, there was one of those usual helmet-to-helmet collisions, and like in the old movie 1975, Rollerball, one guy got up and one guy didn't. The guy who didn't was a 49ers defensive safety named Jeff Fuller, who never played again. He was partially paralyzed, lost the movement in his right arm for the rest of his life. Or right, one of his arms, may have been his left arm. And the other part of that anecdote is because of the different logistics for that game, playing at a temporary stadium that had rushed arrangements. They herded all the riders down to the sideline with 5 minutes left in the game of a pretty much a blowout game. And I'm standing there watching these guys go through, you know, six car crashes every play at close range in a way that I'd never seen. I'd seen in practice. I'd seen at lower levels of football. But it was very disturbing to see all the first-string players still in there, everyone doing the same things they were doing when, you know, the game started and the score was 0-0, because that's the way football is. I mean, you can't really play at half speed. And at one point, there was a pile-up out of bounds a few feet from me, and you know, it was very bothersome. The Mike Holmgren part is that after the game in the locker room, as I'm doing interviews with players and so forth, Mike Holmgren, the quarterback's coach and offensive coordinator of the 49ers then, tapped me on the shoulder and said hello, because he'd been one of my major sources on Joe Montana. And I said to him, you know, that Jeff Fuller play was really scary. And he said, and this is what football people always say to you, it's like, he said, you know what, they're all scary. And they all kind of accept it. So that was a pretty chilling anecdote, which I describe as the day the music died for me about football.
Hmm. But you know, Greg, could I just jump in for a second?
Another NFL story. I'm sorry.
I wanted to jump in and just say one thing about that, and then I'll let you go on if you don't mind. It's interesting. When I read those words from Mike Holmgren, they struck me differently, and I'm not disputing your interpretation at all, but I just thought you might find it interesting to know that when I read those words of Mike Holmgren saying, you know, they're all scary, meaning every play is scary, I took that to mean that Mike Holmgren, at least in some ways, shared your concern, and that, you know, I kind of pictured a head coach always with that awful possibility in their background, in the back of their minds as this game is unfolding. Every play is scary. I think what you're saying, and it's an interesting way to think about those words, is you're suggesting maybe less that Mike Holmgren shared your concern, that he had that concern but had compartmentalized it as a necessary aspect of the game.
No, I think you put it very well, your companion interpretation, and it's really both. And of course, you know, coaches are on a spectrum. Some are more humanitarian than others, but I think, you know, everybody lives with fear of the worst every time they step on the field. And you know, the professionals do it because they've made a decision to do it, and it's a little different than an activity that's just pushed on all boys. And I think that's really my point there. Greg, the other story about an NFL game, of course, is much more recent and more familiar to listeners. And that was the near death of the Buffalo Bills' Damar Hamlin on primetime television in January. And I rushed out a chapter about that on Deadline, because I thought that was a classic example of the NFL flipping the script and a real missed opportunity to talk about something other than traumatic brain injury. And in that game, listeners will recall, Damar Hamlin, a defensive back, made a textbook tackle. It wasn't with his helmet, and you know, it wasn't illegal or improper or anything. And what happened was his opponent's helmet jammed into his chest, the precordium, the front part of the chest that covers the heart, and he went into cardiac arrest in a condition that's called commotio cordis. His heart stopped twice, once on the field, once at the University of Cincinnati Medical Center. The game was stopped, and it was, in an unprecedented way, was actually canceled on ESPN. And so the story over just a few news cycles evolved from the horror of it all, the cost of football, let's put this in perspective, to Hamlin recovering. And last weekend, he actually played again. He's all the way back. And the inspiration of his example, and that is so football. That is so football culture. And the missed opportunity of that week was to talk about the overall harm of football, and instead the practitioners of what I call Concussion Inc., a kind of concussion industrial complex that pushes cottage industries of better helmets, rules tweaks, better safety measures, better return to play protocols. They said that what happened to Damar Hamlin was an outlier. And it's true that there are only a handful of deaths associated with commotio cordis. There are some, and it has happened, including to a kid about 20 years ago. And I thought it was a terrible missed opportunity to have a broader conversation about the sport of football that football fans and football apologists just don't want to have.
We're speaking with Irvin Muchnick, and we're talking about his book, Without Helmets or Shoulder Pads, The American Way of Death in Football Conditioning. He is well known for a previous book called Concussion, Inc., The End of Football as We Know It. In this book, he is exploring yet another troubling aspect of the game of football, namely that sometimes horrific injury is done, sometimes even leading to unnecessary death, in the whole arena of conditioning and on the practice field. And his book is an exploration of that very troubling reality. I wonder if you could tell us about a real-life example that you talk about early in the book, which involves a certain coach that you name, a coach by the name of Randy Walker, and a practice that he had with the whatever team that was, I don't recall off the top of my head, involving his requirements for instance, the running backs on his team, and ultimately what happened to two of his players that you talk about.
Yes, I don't want listeners to have the impression that the Without Helmets or Shoulder Pads is all this like dry, abstract argument. There are three core narratives of specific incidents involving specific young men who perished young and institutional backstories and cover-ups that are absolutely appalling. The one you referred to is the first example, which was the death from bronchial asthma of Rashidi Wheeler in 2001 at Northwestern University during a brutal summer drill where they wind sprints are done consecutively with very little pause in between, with not enough supervision. The funny thing about that, not so funny, it's pretty dark, is that it was videotaped so that the head coach, who under the NCAA rules couldn't be supervising a quote, non-compulsory voluntary workout. It was videotaped for Coach Randy Walker's edification later. And so it's kind of the Rodney King videotape of pro football conditioning, college football conditioning horrors. And so you see this young man, Rashidi Wheeler, collapsing. You see the poor medical care he's given. You see the sprint drills continuing in the background as if nothing had happened. And then finally you see his teammates kneeling in prayer beside him when they realize that he's actually dying, and he did die. The mother of Rashidi Wheeler sued Northwestern University, and she wanted Coach Randy Walker to be fired. She wanted her day in court, and a judge essentially imposed a multimillion-dollar monetary settlement, shoved it down her throat, and that was the end of that. And ironically, Randy Walker himself had a heart attack shortly after getting a contract extension and died. Then there are two other anecdotes, one right in my backyard in California at the University of California, Berkeley, which again, like Northwestern, is a very distinguished academic school. But when, you know, our public or private colleges get involved in the football industry, their hands get dirty. And in 2014, a young man, Southern California kid, son of Nigerian immigrants named Ted Agu, died during a bizarre 6 a.m. February off-season conditioning drill of something called exertional sickling, an exertional attack associated with sickle cell trait, which is something that afflicts 1 in 12 African-American men and is an especially poignant subset of football harm and football death, given the wildly disproportionate representation of African-Americans in NCAA Division I and NFL player ranks. As I tell in three chapters of my book, Cal covered up the circumstances of Agu's death, even getting the Alameda County Medical Examiner to rule that it was a generic heart disease situation when it was well known that Ted Agu was a sickle cell trait carrier. So these are some of the horror stories, along with the exertional heat stroke death of 19-year-old Braden Bradforth at a small community college in Kansas in 2018 at what is kind of last chance U for black aspirants of football. All of these stories combined dramatize and I hope focus the mind on the real cost, not just to individuals, but to society, of this out of control sport of football.
We're speaking with Irvin Muchnick about his book, Without Helmets or Shoulder Pads, The American Way of Death in Football Conditioning. Do you have time for a few more questions?
Absolutely. Enjoying the dialogue.
One of the things I appreciate about the book, and it gives it kind of a different texture than we might think, is the fact that, although obviously the central matter is this tragedy that is part of the game, but that in many cases we are learning a lot about these young men who figure in these stories. And, for instance, this young man you've just mentioned by the name of Ted Agu, you write, if you were searching for a central casting exhibit of a student athlete who was in football purely for the love of the game, Ted Agu was your guy. I appreciate the fact that you want to spend the time to tell us a little bit about who some of these players were, even off the football field. Tell us a little more about this young man.
Yeah, he was a pre-med student. He was 250 pounds. He was a sort of in between a linebacker and a defensive lineman, and he was a really good player in high school in Bakersfield, California, but he was not quite fast enough to play behind the line, not quite large enough and strong enough to play on the line. So he really was not an NFL prospect, and he was a walk-on. He didn't have a scholarship, and but became kind of a leader of the team and in practices, in the weight room, and in study halls. He was a very driven and a serious young man. And you know, his parents were floored by, as so many parents are, but not until it happens to them, by how inattentive the University of California was to its what you might call its in loco parentis role, while in custody of their son. And and they filed a lawsuit, and in the course of depositions and discovery, it came out in ways developed in my book that everyone from moment one of the death realized that it was a sickling episode, not a coronary episode, and did all they could to put their thumb on the scales of the investigation of the county sheriff and coroner so that the ruling would come out in a way that didn't harm the image of Cal football. But it did come out 2 years later. As Mark Twain said, the truth gets fully dressed and is twice around the world before, rather the lie, it's twice around the world before the truth even puts its boots on. So 2 years later, during the lawsuit, the full truth came out. It was never well reported in the local media. And I had to do a California Public Records Act fight that lasted 5 years to acquire more internal documents from the university about what had happened. The family settled for $4.75 million. Which is otherwise known in football world as a cost of doing business. And they turned the page and moved on. They put a plaque of Ted Agu up at Memorial Stadium, and a life cut short, a very promising life cut short. In New Jersey, there was a 19-year-old kid, Braden Bradforth, who had no prospects at all and didn't even know if he was going to go to college in New Jersey, and got a call from Garden City Community College in Kansas in the summer of 2018 and said, come on out and play football for us. He jumped on the second airplane flight of his life, and he was dead in 72 hours on the first day of practice in southwestern Kansas. So I got to know a lot of these horrible stories. In some cases, as in Braden Bradforth's case, became friends of family members and survivors. And I think people need to understand that every time there's one of these deaths in football, and there have probably been more than 1,000 of them in high school football in the last 90 years, it's a mother bereaved, it's a family bereaved, it's a community that loses someone. These are casualties of war that I think are really unacceptable in the domestic confines of a game.
I think one of the really interesting aspects of what occurred in the incident with the University of California, Berkeley, again with Ted Agu, you tell us about how there had been a shift in the coaching office, and then one of the first things that happened there was that this new head coach, the last name of Dykus, brought in his own strength and conditioning assistant from Louisiana Tech, where he had been before, someone by the name of Damon Harrington. And it sounds like the whole culture of conditioning at Berkeley changed dramatically with Damon Harrington. And I bring it up only because it seems like we're often talking about kind of a prevailing culture that will make what is always a significant risk even more acute. Tell us a little more about this Damon Harrington and the different way in which he went about the whole matter of conditioning.
Right. Well, what you often see in these bad football outcomes, deaths or clusters of rhabdomyolysis that nearly kill groups of kids, is what they call culture change. If a team is fallen on hard times and they bring in a new coach, part of his mandate is to make sure they're not as soft as they were under the old coach. And he brings in his own strength and conditioning guy, and they do these crazy things like the drill that killed Ted Agu. Sonny Dykes was the coach, the head coach at the University of California. He didn't do very well, but he's the toast of college football right now. He moved on to SMU and then to Texas Christian University in Fort Worth, Texas, and he took them to the national championship game last year. Every single figure involved in the Cal story fell upward in the football system. Damon Harrington went on to become the strength and conditioning coach, ironically, at Grambling, historically black Grambling University in Louisiana, after killing a kid because of sickle cell trait. The team physician at California was Dr. Casey Batten. He's the person who called the medical examiner as he was about to cut into Ted Agu's body and said, you know what, we think it's an open and shut case of hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, a thickened heart. And when the documents show and the timeline shows that every single person inside the football complex that day was hoping against hope that the coroner would not find that it was sickle cell trait, which was what everyone knew it was. And Dr. Casey Batten went from Cal to the Los Angeles Rams, where he's one of the team physicians, and he's at the prestigious Cedars-Sinai clinic in Los Angeles. So culture change, the backstory, toxic strength and conditioning programs such as killed Ted Agu and killed from exertional heat stroke Jordan McNair at the University of Maryland in 2018. These are part and parcel of the stories of football death and football harm.
You go on to say, I mean, you use unbridled language in describing the way in which this was handled at Berkeley as a cover-up, which, and I wonder if you could just touch on at least a couple of the most basic ways in which this cover-up was achieved.
Well, one of the ways is with the campus police, who there was a whistleblower on the team who complained up the chain all the way to a vice chancellor, who sent him to the campus cops. And this player, a backup quarterback, told the story not just of Ted Agu, but of an incident at practice 3 months earlier, when one player, in a kind of code red assault out of the movie A Few Good Men, battered and sent into the hospital a teammate who had skipped a conditioning drill the day before, and had sort of been wink wink set upon that mission by strength and conditioning coach Harrington. Well, the whistleblower player went to the campus cops and they said, okay, thank you for your time. Nothing came of it. They also, the campus police interviewed Damon Harrington and about whether or not he knew about sickle cell trait, because that was in the rumor mill, and then called him back for a do-over interview where they coached him to all the best answers that they wanted for the record. So on and on and on, you see a cover-up, a term I use advisedly. I think it's more like, it's not the My Lai massacre. It's more like Defense Secretary McNamara and his generals cooking the books on Vietnam War casualties.
Right.
So I think we need a bit of nuance there.
Sure.
But I think cover-up is the appropriate term. There were 141 pages of Berkeley campus police records that were generated in investigating the Agu death, and only a portion of them were shared with the Alameda County Sheriff's Office, which investigated on behalf of the coroner. So it's a cover up that was perfectly consonant with the biases of their audience. I don't think the boosters, the alums, the fans wanted to know the truth about Ted Agu. And one of the great institutions of higher learning, probably the greatest public university in the world, University of California at Berkeley, did their level best to make sure that nobody ever really knew.
What is especially troubling to me is when at one point you write, the cover-up quarterback for Cal was Dr. Casey Batten, the football team physician. That's really disturbing to think about.
You could say the Hippocratic oath is first do no harm to football world.
Right. I mean, because here is somebody who one would think by his very job description is entrusted with safeguarding the health and well-being of those players. At least as you assess the situation, he is a chief participant in this cover-up.
Couldn't agree with you more. And football team physicians at all levels are serving two masters. You know, the medical needs of the athletes they're supervising and are in charge of promoting the health of, and the institutions that hire them and their profit motives. It's a very sad situation.
One of the bits of language that come up kind of again and again is the winning edge. I think that might have been part of the story of the first story that we were talking about of Rashidi Wheeler and Jason Wright. But this notion of whatever it takes to gain that winning edge, over our potential opponents. I mean, on the surface, sounds good, and in some respects is sort of part of the whole point of it. And yet, what your book is suggesting is that very notion of achieving a winning edge at whatever cost can come with a terrible price tag, especially if that becomes the overriding goal over everything else.
Yeah, that's the ethos of football. The winning edge, I think, was the term that Randy Walker used for his drill at Northwestern, which Rashidi Wheeler died. But really, you see it over and over and used in this very inchoate way. Again, my gripe with football is that there's a lot of puffery around things that don't involve technique or things that we can isolate and identify as giving you a true competitive advantage. And there's a lot of energy put into concepts like toughness and never quitting and so forth. And, you know, there's no question that these values in sports do apply and do have some value and meaning. But the extreme, universally accepted and assumed position that whatever an autocratic coach does in the name of toughness or what he calls a winning edge is appropriate is something that sports parents, again, at non-professional levels, at the discretionary level of deciding whether their young man or boy should get involved in this, this is something that needs to be processed more by America's sports parents.
Right. Have we yet talked about Jordan McNair, a football player at the University of Maryland, and his story?
I referred to it very briefly in connection with Ted Agu in talking about the toxic nature of the conditioning program there that killed him in 2018. And he is in the book in connection with the death just a couple months later of Braden Bradforth, because exertional heat stroke is the number one killer of young men in football.
You write at one point, any critic of football who will not concede that the sport has artistry as well as brutality leaves himself open to being held as both not credible and hopelessly ideological. Football is popular for many reasons, and some are good ones. The sport does entertain, and it is not devoid of redeeming social value. But do the trade-offs make sense? No. I think one thing that maybe some people who feel differently might argue is that that we are judging the game on the basis of the Damon Harringtons and the Randy Walkers and others, and that the game itself should not be indicted for the wrongdoing of certain people who cross a line that should not be crossed. But I think you would argue that there is something about the game of football that is more than just the transgressions of specific trainers and coaches.
I would agree with that, and I think I'm guided in part by my friend Bob Costas, who kindly provided one of the blurbs on the back cover of my book. And I think that, you know, first of all, you're not going to persuade people by only talking about the sins and transgressions of football, and by not acknowledging that a lot of people get a big thrill out of playing it, and millions of people get a big thrill out of watching it. So that's why I say, you know, you can't start out by, you know, saying you can ban something that's so popular. I would challenge the idea that the problem is renegade coaches or isolated incidents when you have a situation where there is a measurable social pandemic of death every single year just from conditioning. There's something structurally wrong here. I think people need to reflect on the idea that when some future historian or archaeologist. You know, when we get our Edward Gibbon writing about the American Empire, they're not going to say that football was sort of like the gladiators in the Colosseum. They're going to say it was exactly like that. And with that in mind, people might want to take a step back and consider my proposals for at least downsizing this blood sport, which again, admittedly, is very popular and has certain aspects of community building and fun and entertainment that are part of any culture.
Sure. That was going to be my last question. Towards the end of the book, you write, a campaign to curtail football and its carnage requires a multifaceted approach, and one in which we can't dwell on generalities or just certain aspects of the game. At least in a nutshell, what would such a multifaceted approach look like?
Yeah, and again, I'm trying to steer people away from the hegemony of the regime we're in right now, which is Concussion Inc., the Concussion Industrial Complex. Let's look at everything. And what I proposed, and I did it in an op-ed piece in the Chicago Tribune a couple of months ago, and it's a long campaign of activism, and it's a far-reaching proposal, but we need to get this sport out of our public schools and out of our public fields. No more subsidies from our K-12 school systems, our community colleges, and our public universities. And it's going to be a long fight. It's going to be community by community. Admittedly, it has the danger, because of the distribution of opportunities in our society, of having an impact mostly on more socioeconomically privileged communities and high schools, where we are starting to see slowly a fall off in participation and even a hard time fielding teams, and less so in places like rural Texas, which is the Friday Night Lights country. And we're in danger of evolving into a situation where we have an explicit gladiator class that, because of curtailed other opportunities, is endangering its own population. And I'm talking about the African-American community and other marginalized communities, all for the entertainment of the masses. So it's a complex societal problem, but I think it starts with people thinking about getting this blood sport out of our public schools and off our public fields. Hmm.
The book, again, is Without Helmets or Shoulder Pads, The American Way of Death in Football Conditioning, published by ECW Press, the author, Irvin Muchnick. Irvin Muchnick, thank you so much for writing this powerful and important book, and thank you for being my morning show guest today.
Thanks for having me, Greg. I really enjoyed the dialogue.
Next week on The Morning Show Monday, we will be previewing what promises to be an exciting concert by the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra next Saturday, a concert that will feature Beethoven's Eroica Symphony and Tchaikovsky's Violin Concerto. We'll talk with the conductor, the president of the board of the directors, and the violin soloist all on Monday's morning show. On Tuesday, we'll be previewing for you the next concert by the Choral Arts Society with James Schatzman. On Wednesday next week, Michael D. Smith, the author of a really intriguing book called The Abundant University, which calls for colleges and universities to rethink themselves and their mission in the wake of the digital revolution. Next Thursday, it is Nan Calvert and her monthly visit to the program. She'll have with her an expert on plastics in the environment and some ideas on what we can do to reduce that impact. 1 week from today, the widow of Joe Papp, one of the giants of American theater, talking about her new memoir. Our weather forecast is for cloudy, windy, rainy conditions with a high today of just 59 degrees. Cloudy, rainy, cool, windy conditions will continue tonight, tomorrow, and perhaps into Sunday, although the rain chance for Sunday and Monday has been reduced a little bit. The first sunshine in our forecast, not till next Wednesday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News.